being well-intended isn't enough. Being tolerant isn't enough. Even, I would argue, being accepting isn't enough. What you have to do now is, I think, is indicate your proactive support. So, because things aren't going to change if you're just hands off the wheel. Oh, I love everybody. And equality is like something I believe in.
Hey, Warners, welcome to Women Your Mother Warned You About,
the podcast that makes everything sexy again.
I'm Gina Tremarco, sales trainer and consultant at Pivot 10 Results and founder of Carolina Improv, the number one nightlife attraction in Myrtle Beach on TripAdvisor since 2010.
And I'm Rachel Pitts. I'm a mom, a wifey, and a real estate agent for BRG turned loan officer with U.S. Mortgage.
Hey, this is another hot episode.
Intense is what it is.
Right? Like, we didn't even, all those questions I prepared did not need to be used, which
very
thought-provoking. Is awesome.
My brain was going very hard during this episode because I was thinking of just so many situations of things that, in situations that I've been in that I know people were made to feel uncomfortable and not included, just trying to figure out what that must feel like in large corporate situations. It's very thought-provoking.
I saw like how serious you were, like your face. I'm like, what is she thinking right now?
There was a lot of things.
Very thought-provoking. Jennifer Brown was our guest on this show that we had. She's amazing. A little bit about her, give everyone her background. Jennifer Brown is a leading diversity and inclusion expert, dynamic keynote speaker, best-selling author, award-winning entrepreneur, and host of the Will to Change podcast, which uncovers true stories of diversity and inclusion. As the founder, president, and CEO of Jennifer Brown Consulting, Jennifer's workplace strategies have been employed by some of the world's top Fortune 500 companies and nonprofits, including Walmart, Microsoft, Starbucks, Toyota, T-Mobile, and many others, to help employees bring their full selves to work and feel welcomed, valued, respected, and heard. She's got so much experience and background. I think you're going to find her really interesting. She's also known as a successful female and LGBT entrepreneur, and she understands what it means for an individual to minimize or hide aspects of their true self in the workplace for fear of not being fully embraced. She's been featured in media such as the New York Times, Bloomberg Businessweek, Forbes, Fortune, Inc., The Wall Street Journal, Harvard Business Review, CBS, Fox News, and many more. And on this episode, I did mention that I want to be her when I grow up.
So it sounds like she's credible.
She's super credible and super fun.
Yeah. And it's, again, I was thinking throughout this, and I bet you that some of you out there, if you have an open mind, you will be able to think of situations where you've heard someone mention, either because of a person's race, because of a person's sexual orientation or gender choice, you've heard off-color jokes, comments. You've been in situations that were obviously, there wasn't full inclusion yet. And I think that it's a scenario that's more and more prevalent in our world. And some people would rather not talk about it, but here we are talking about it.
Mm-hmm. And I think it'll be also eye-opening about our own unconscious bias that we have and don't even realize, all the different groups that are not included and how we make judgment calls without even thinking about it.
Oh, yeah. Like, I have, you know, this stack of business cards 2 inches thick of people that I'm following up with. And, you know, I'll admit, like, you come to one business card and you look at the name on it and you immediately make a judgment. Like, no matter how good of a human or Christian or whatever you are, you're sometimes going to make an unconscious bias choice about just even their name. Even if there's not an image of the person on the business card or whatever, it's there. It's in all of us, I think. I think it's part of what makes us human is trying to work through that. And Jennifer has some great tips on that in this episode.
It was really interesting. One quick note, and then we'll start the show. when I heard her speak the first time, and I was thinking about my own unconscious bias, I realized that back in the day when I was hiring a lot of employees in the IMAX world, especially in Myrtle Beach, I found myself judging resumes based on what state they came from. Because I was so frustrated with the workforce that I'm like, okay, everyone from Ohio seems to be hardworking, so that's all I'm going to hire, people from Ohio.
Wow.
So I didn't, you know what I mean?
You never know where it's going to show up.
Not even right. So we're always willing to learn. You're going to learn a lot on this episode. So enjoy this episode with Jennifer Brown. All right, Jennifer Brown, welcome to The Women Your Mother Warned You About.
Watch out. Happy to be here. Juicy.
You've been warned, right?
Oh, yeah. And I broke free. And now I'm dangerous as hell, and I'm loving it.
Oh, that's awesome. Jennifer and I met. This is so cool because I think Televerity gets so much. You know what? I need to approach Michelle about sponsoring the show.
Yes, hello.
Because I talk so much about my trip to prison.
I loved my trip to prison. We must debrief.
Oh, goodness. Wasn't it amazing?
So that's amazing.
That's where Jennifer and I met, and I heard Jennifer speaking on this panel of power women. We talked about this on another episode. I'm like, they all came in really powerful in their pantsuits out of a limo, and I'm like, boo, the women are here.
We felt badass. We felt amazing.
You guys walked in badass.
Hold on. You showed up in a limo?
In a stretch limo.
To go into prison.
The optics aren't the greatest. I agree. That did occur to me.
You know, the only time I've ever ridden in a limo ever in my 43 years is we went bowling. We were in Atlantic City. I was in a show in Atlantic City, and it was the cheapest way to get to the bowling alley. So we took like three stretch limos.
Yeah, but what about prom? Weren't you in one for prom?
Oh, girl, no, I didn't go to prom like that. I went to a small art school.
Oh, that's fun. That's where I should have been instead of in a giant 16 candles-like scenario in Orange County, California. Oh. Yeah.
Wow,
so
we have a lot of diversity here. I went to an all-girls Catholic high school. Completely different world.
Three completely different worlds, I assure you.
Talk about diversity and inclusion. So I thought the other cool thing about Jennifer was that the three of us all share a similar string, which is coming from a performance arts background.
Wow. I love that we share that.
I thought that would be super cool because, A, I fell in love with Jennifer, by the way. And I like literally said to her, will you please be my mentor?
Oh, always.
Because I was listening to her story on the panel, and we'll get you to talk about that. And I was like, I want to be her when I grow up.
That's so nice. Goodness. Yeah.
Oh, no pressure.
Blushing.
Yeah. No pressure. We'll talk about that. But one thing that we've started to do with this show is kind of started out with a crazy question.
Okay.
And that crazy question is, do you, Jennifer Brown, consider yourself a woman your mother warned you about?
Oh, yeah. I could elaborate on that one.
Please do.
I'm sort of the woman she prepared me to be, but didn't really mean to prepare me to be this way because she was a badass, not a working mom, but literally like could have been a COO of a major corporation kind of mom. Like she ran all of our Girl Scout troops. She was like so organized. She was just in charge. She was a really strong person. And I was a bit of a free spirit kid and an artist and, you know, expressive and feeler, very emotional. And she's very like, get it done. She's the boss. Like, so very different from me, but I think pushed me really hard, taught me to be organized, taught me to be a go-getter. And yet I've become, I think, the voice I have in the world and the topic that I tackle is one that, you know, I think she's a lot more traditional than I am, from a values perspective, from a religious perspective, from a political perspective. So I'm actually, she birthed me. I think it probably surprised the heck out of my parents to be like, wow, like look what she's doing in the world and what she's passionate about. And like, does that align with what we believe? So I don't want to get too deep into the family dynamics, but yeah, they birthed me and then some, and then I took it to a whole different level. Sorry.
You're like, thanks, mom and dad.
Yeah, but guess what?
I'm going to heighten this.
Yeah, I'm going to take it to the next level.
In improv, we call it yes anding, heightening it to the next, heightening it to the next level.
I'm a yes and kid. I mean, like coming out at when I was 22 as LGBTQ was a big like, in a way, sort of flip the bird moment to your parents. I mean, it always is. It's sort of like, hey, by the way, like, thanks for everything. And like, I'm going to go and choose a whole different path than what I was groomed to have, you know, and that was a tremendously liberating and important moment in my life. It changed the whole course of my life.
And how did your, we don't have to get too deep, but how did that, how did your family react and how did that impact, let me rephrase the question. Did that impact your passion for diversity and inclusion?
Totally. Are you kidding? I mean, to literally like know that you've, in honoring your heart and who you fall in love with, you are literally like stepping away from like all the programming, like all the scripts, all the expectations, a lot of like the gender roles, the, and you know, all of it. And I think it can, for some parents, it can feel like a repudiation of what they've taught you. It could come as a complete surprise, which it did for mine. And to me too, kind of, right? I didn't necessarily anticipate all of this. I wasn't the kid that was 5 years old and was like, oh my gosh, I think I'm gay. I wasn't that kid. I mean, I'm probably somewhere on the spectrum of sexual orientation. But I'm also very much, I think, very feminine identified when it comes to gender identity, which if you want me to explain any of that, let me know. It's a little complicated, but they're very different. Mm-hmm. You know, who you are romantically attracted to, who you want to build your life with, and the gender of that person is really different than how we view our gender. That's a different question. How I view my gender, I'm comfortable in a feminine expression, which is really interesting because when I first came out, I looked around at the community, and this was 25 years ago. I didn't see any women that looked like me. And so I would go out and everybody would assume that I was somebody's straight friend. And it was really difficult to get any kind of attention. So I think even within communities, of course, we know that there's bias and assumptions about what a member of the community looks like. And I still get to play with that on keynote stages everywhere where I get to walk on stage and come out and like literally 1,000 people will be just silent, you know, just shocked. And that's really an interesting data point for us in terms of, you know, in the audience, I'm sure we're checking their own bias and having that moment of like, oh gosh, that didn't even cross my mind about who Jennifer is. And then
I'll be honest, that was my reaction.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's why it's important actually to show up and to talk about my story and talk about my partner of 20 years, Michelle, and our life. And there's a lot more of us, but we are really good at hiding. I think many of us pass in our lives. It depends what kind of company we work for, how embracing they are, where we live in the country and in the world. We're there, but we are even invisible to each other. Mm-hmm. Often women in the community, we have a very difficult time connecting and even seeing each other and finding each other, which is, you know, lonely, but it just means that when you find each other, you sort of cling for dear life. And they're probably my dearest friends are my woman friends in the community.
Why do you think that is, that it's difficult to see each other, find each other?
Yeah, because you know what? We're also dealing with being women in the world.
That's hard enough in itself.
That's hard enough, right? Right. And then you think we're in male-dominated environments, like everywhere we go, almost everywhere we go. Particularly professionally, and I focus on the workplace and my work. But so we're dealing with that, and I think then to layer on the fact that you're LGBTQ and the fact that you can actually hide it and sort of selectively share, some of us can, means that we're always thinking about like, well, how much do I really need to share and how much can I sort of keep because I don't want to trigger even more bias perhaps in people around me. And then if you're a woman of color, I just have to say like that's an additional layer. So,
right.
You know, LGBTQ women of color have three things going on that are stigmatized. And literally, like, they walk into a business meeting and the color is not something you can hide. And so right away, you know that that's something you can't opt out of. But you can not really make it a big deal that you're, you know, you're female and you may be hearing jokes that are inappropriate. Like you can choose not to say something, you know, you can kind of not really make it a big deal. And you could put up with that. But I think being LGBTQ, if you have any control over anything, that might be something that you really, really choose not to talk about. And therefore, we can't see each other.
Okay.
So interesting. Like I'm listening to all of these things that you say, and I come from a very artistic background, and you know, I know so many wonderful, some of the greatest humans that I know are gay couples, female, female, male, male, whatever, the greatest parents, like such wonderful people. And I'm a parent that, like, my daughter's 11. And if she came, if she decided to come to me one day and come out, I'd be like, cool. Like, it's, I'm a person that's so open to it. And it's such a shame that whatever the universe decides sometimes that the children of parents that are have that bias built in that leads you to an experience like you had, that it was painful rather than like, okay, I support you. I mean, mm-hmm. I think it's just uncommon, but maybe it's starting to regress. Personally, I don't really care who you're attracted to. If you're nice to me, like, it's none of my business.
Right?
Really?
It should be that simple.
Like, it should be, but it's not. And I know from, you know, the perspective of my buddies that, like, a couple of people that live here in South Carolina, you can imagine.
Oh.
South Carolina is a little bit...
Barb Royal.
That's what I'm talking about. Barb and Tracy. Yeah. They're
the most amazing family.
They are the greatest. Like, they're some of my most fave people. Barb Royal did an episode with us early on in this podcast. And, I mean, we're talking serious quality people. And they have a hard time with bias in this area.
Right. Yeah, I know. It's a journey. I have a lot more parents coming up to me in my keynotes in workplaces. So clients bring me in. I speak to tons of managers. And they come up to me and say, I'm so glad you're here. My kid just came out to me as trans and I don't know what to do. And this is happening more and more. They come out as gender non-binary. They want to be called they, them pronouns. So it's happening more and more. And I think people are caught not ready because of bias or perhaps because they never thought that this would be something that touches their lives. And so in a way, I'm this harbinger for people to say, not just in your personal life, but in the workplace, you have team members and colleagues who literally are closeted. So you wouldn't actually know because we are afraid. And so the question becomes then from a leadership perspective, we have this great dialogue about, well, then how do I create a safe space and indicate to people and signal to people that I'm the kind of person that they can work with, that I will celebrate who you are. I will support you. I will fight for you to be seen in this place. You know, how do you indicate that? You know, and I like to say, you know, I like to share my pronouns. Like I give that example. I say I'm Jennifer Brown. My pronouns are she, her, hers. And like, just like toss it off like it's nothing so that whoever needs to hear that in that moment hears it.
Mm-hmm.
And then for those who don't know what I'm talking about, it's a great invitation to dialogue, to say, they might be like, what did you say? Like, what does that mean? And when I speak on it, I ask for a show of hands and I say, well, how many of you know what I mean when I talk about pronouns? Like no hands go up in most of the audiences that I speak to. So it's a great opportunity.
That's amazing.
I know, isn't it? That's the audiences that I find myself with, and they need the most help. I mean, I think the older generations know the least about diversity and inclusion.
They don't know what to do.
And obviously, they don't know anything about it. And they're not used to not knowing, particularly if they're leaders in organizations. They don't like to admit what they don't know, right? This is the fate worse than death. I've got to have all the answers. I have to be infallible. I'm in charge. I have this big title. And yet they are hopeless on this stuff. And so we have a really interesting dichotomy going on with all these young people coming into the workplace being like, I want to be seen and heard. I want to be authentic. I want to bring my full self. And then companies not talking about it, total silence, not knowing what to say, visibly struggling with language and certainly not, you know, if they do say anything, not doing it very authentically and comfortably, like as if it's part of their day-to-day life. So it's a very interesting, and so I think it's concerning. I mean, if I were a leader and I really didn't know anything about all this, I should be concerned about my viability as a leader because leader is nothing without followership.
Wouldn't the simple answer be to be open and accepting? wouldn't that be the simple answer? But it's not as simple as that.
Yes, yes, and.
Yes, the simple answer would be like, let's just see. But people just, humans complicate that shit immediately.
We do. And by the way, I think the yes and to that actually is that being well-intended isn't enough. Being tolerant isn't enough. Even I would argue being accepting isn't enough. What you have to do now is, I think, is indicate your proactive support. So, because things aren't going to change if you're just hands off the wheel. Oh, I love everybody. And equality is like something I believe in. It's actually not enough to not only just maintain inclusive environments around you, but actually build more inclusive environments. It's not enough. And often well-intended people, that intention is invisible. That acceptance is invisible. So I don't see it.
Right.
Therefore, I'm going to think the worst, because that's another bias we have. We tend to think the worst of others.
Right.
And silence speaks volumes. If I'm on the other end of that communication or lack thereof or whatever, I'm going to be like, well, you know, I don't see anyone that looks like me. Nobody's talking about things that affect me. Nobody shares my, I mean, I'm not hearing anything. Therefore, my company doesn't get it or my colleague doesn't get it. So I do think we have to grow that yes and piece is the proactive. I know something about this. I'm not treating everyone the same. I'm not one of those people that says I don't see color or I don't see gender. What we're saying now in diversity is we need to actually see all those things and actually talk about them and not erase them.
And
because they are having
action.
A lot to do with us. They're having a lot to do with our experience every day. So let's talk about it.
It's really about taking action.
Yes, it is.
It's not just a acceptance piece. You know, I know you do a lot of speaking and a lot of working with leaders, and you probably do a lot with emotional intelligence.
Yeah.
And when I'm looking at emotional intelligence, a lot of times when I'm working with leaders, we talk about empathy. Well, once I had a leader say to me, I don't feel like I need to be empathetic. Well, that's a whole nother story.
Wow.
That really set me back.
Goodness me.
But empathy, you know, the one thing I say to them is empathy is great, but without the compassion to move it forward.
I might even say commitment to move it forward.
Right. You have to be compelled.
Right.
To take that empathy to the next level.
That's very true. So true. That's why in my new book, there's a model that goes from unaware to aware to active to advocate. So notice that we didn't stop at aware. Aware is, okay, now I know there's a problem. Okay, now I know maybe women in my organization don't feel like they have a fair shot like I do. Or maybe we don't pay people equally. So aware is like the, you know, truth and reconciliation, but then active is, okay, what do you do with that knowledge? What do you do with that awareness? And that's where it gets really interesting, because I don't know if you all saw this, but in the age of Me Too, there's some data from Lean In that says that men are sort of pulling away from those one-on-one relationships at work with women that have everything to do with our ability to succeed, you know, and be chosen for things and be sponsored and mentored and be, you know, suggested for a role or a stretch assignment or, you know, and that pulling away is that fear that's a result of this, allegedly of this like Me Too age that we live in. And that's really distressing to me, that leaders wouldn't be courageous enough to say, no, actually, I'm gonna lean in as a man into this, because now more than ever, it's so important to show what a good and healthy working relationship looks like. I'm going to challenge myself. I'm going to push into that fear, because I don't have anything to be afraid of if I'm not acting inappropriately.
Right, exactly.
Well, what would your advice be to a man? And I know you guys talked about this on the panel a little bit. What would your advice be to a man who is fearful beyond saying lean in? Because they probably won't understand what that even means.
I know. And I wish they would have read the book, which is actually one piece of advice I'd probably start with. You know, lean in isn't just for women. You know, and books about by and about the experience of people of color aren't just for people of color. You know, I just interviewed Minda Hartz, who wrote a book called The Memo, which is basically the lean in for women of color. And she's getting so much traction. And she said, no white women show up to my book events. No white women buy my book. And it's such a call to action for me as a, not only as a D&I leader that's coaching leaders, but somebody, it's just as an individual, like, how do I up my learning about a culture and an identity that's not mine is critical for me as a human in the world. My advice would be, so read, consume media that's not about your identity. have people in your corner with whom you've built trust to actually ask, how am I doing? Am I supporting you? Where do you need support? Where are you feeling challenged based on perhaps bias? You're not sure. Maybe you're hearing microaggressions, every day. Like, how can I, as your ally, as your accomplice, support you or jump in or have a conversation with somebody offline? How can I speed your way to being able to thrive? And what's getting in the way of that ability to thrive? If that conversation were had, I think some of us that are feeling sort of thwarted at every turn in the modern workplace, which is still full of bias, if we had somebody in our corner to be, running interference for us, with us, behind us, invisibly, visibly, that would be enormous. I mean, allyship is, like, as an LGBT person, straight allies have been like this amazing, like, balm for the soul. Like, you can't imagine what it feels like to have somebody that's like, hey, I'm in your corner. Like, I will advocate for you when you're tired, when you're sick of doing this, when you don't have any energy left. Like, we'll take the baton and we'll run with it for a while. Like, that is an amazing feeling. And for women to have a man in your corner as an ally, it, again, like, think about that. Like, and I hope who's listening to this, and the men here too, you're aware of when you've made a difference for somebody else because of something very easy for you to do that would have been harder for the woman to do, but easier for you to do as a man. So this is not even like a ton of work. It's literally just asking the question, where can I apply maybe the privilege or the ease that I have in the world that was made for me to be successful in and not made for somebody else to be successful in? Like, how then can I use that to be helpful? It's very small. It's not a huge lift, but it does require good listening, paying attention, checking in, getting that feedback, asking the questions. I mean, imagine what it would feel like for us to be asked those kinds of questions in our career, because we're not privy to the rules. Like, if you're an outsider and there's insider games going on, for whatever reason, because of your diversity, you're not getting the really critical advice that you need in order to sort of know what's getting in your way, how things really work, sort of the unofficial rules, the unwritten rules. We need to be privy to those things so that we can move forward. And so that's why you really, really need allies on the inside.
So what about those people anybody who might be subjected to bias, if they're not in that type of organization? Mm. And they're aware of that's happening. What should they do?
Yeah. Well, I might say band together with others of your identity is one solution. And I hope you have those. You may not.
Yeah.
Right. If you're a woman of color, you might be the only woman on right. your team. If you're on a technical team, it's pretty isolating and pretty lonely. So I always do think though that there is an ally out there for you. Somewhere in your organization. If you can't find that person, either in your community or somebody cross difference, outside of your organization, there are communities in cities that gather women technologists, women who code, women of color in law. There's a lot of different trade associations. There's tons of conferences out there for every identity. There's an amazing disabilities conference that I go to, Disability In, IN. There are veterans groups. So anyway, whatever your difference is that you're feeling is not supported or not reflected around you, it's very dangerous to feel isolated and alone. So remember, find your people, even if it means you have to travel many miles to go to a conference where you can kind of breathe and be like, ah, these are my people. Like, there's a giant LGBTQ conference. There's a bunch of them, but there's one I go to called Out and Equal, and there's 7,000 of us. It's incredible. It keeps you going for an entire year between conferences because and you see the commitment of companies and you see all the 200 people from Bank of America. Now, people still feel lonely at that conference if you're trans and if you're a person of color. The LGBTQ community still has inclusion issues too. And that's really important to know that you may still feel that you're kind of an outsider within an outsider group. And that is important to acknowledge. And that's a call to action, I think, for those of us, literally all of us can be allies, even those of us in these quote unquote marginalized groups. So as an LGBTQ woman, I am still cisgender. So that means I get to walk through the world. I get to choose when I come out. I am sort of socially acceptable because like I'm gender normative in terms of my expression. So I don't challenge people's thinking about gender in the way I present myself. I think that is a level of ease that I have, right? So that I can then represent those who do challenge gender norms and who might make people feel uncomfortable. I can speak to that. And that's why I need to, and that's why I always try to. So I think, you know, just because you're in a quote unquote marginalized community doesn't mean you're an inclusive leader. And that is like an important thing to remember, that just because we have an experience of exclusion and we're in this kind of underrepresented community, you still have to work to build the skills to be an inclusive leader, because we literally replicate an unequal society in our own communities of difference as well. So there's all kinds of hierarchies within these groups that should know better, honestly.
Hey, Warners, this is Gina Tremarco, and if you know Rachel and I, you know how much we love our beauty strategies, especially Dermavogue, where we both go to keep our faces looking younger and healthier. Every time someone says to me, "Something looks different about your face," I can't help but to tell them that the Dermavogue team, led by Dr. James Turek, has been offering the greater Myrtle Beach area the best in cosmetic and aesthetic dermatology since 2003. Dermavogue combines expert medical knowledge with cutting-edge technology, bringing their patients the most effective, flawless solutions to any skincare or cosmetic need. Some of the services to consider include Botox, skin peels, facials, Bio-T, and much more. I personally love and highly recommend their Botox and lip injections for making my face look younger and healthier, and for Bio-T for improving my energy, sleep, and weight control. At Dermavogue, they gauge you in the process of total body health to ensure your satisfaction with their comprehensive selection of the most up-to-date, non-invasive cosmetic dermatology and spa treatments. If you want to look and feel your best, Dermavogue can help you get there. Schedule your consultation today by calling 843-357-2444 or visit dermavogue.com and tell them that the women your mother warned you about sent you.
So what kind of situations, like give an example or so of if you're in the workplace, what would be an action that you wish would happen for people? Because really, from the 30,000 foot view, you know, hopefully people are being hired for their skill level, but then the personal stuff comes into it and the bias shows up for everybody when they find out that Jennifer is that group or whatever. So then, you know what I mean? So what would be an action that would feel good? Because I'm sure, like, I'm sitting here going, well, I wonder what could do. I mean, I just try to, for me, it's no big deal, but that's because of where I come from and my artistic background. It's like part of the ballet world. It just is.
Lovely.
But I know that that's great. Unique to the world. And most people, you know, same thing, like you walk into a room and you have one political belief and people are blatantly spewing their political belief and you may not, you know, agree. There's so many ways that make people uncomfortable, but in your specific group, what would be an action that would feel good for you from another person's point of view?
Yeah, well, you know, there's so much bias, even in terms of names on resumes that happens, wow. Right? There's Joe versus Jose, yeah. Exactly the same background, totally like the data shows that literally there's like an appreciable difference in terms of whether people get through the net to even be interviewed. So literally, if you work for any kind of company, you're around any kind of interviewing process, bias occurs like right at the start of that. And I think if we can advocate for a more fair process, and sadly, we are literally helpless often in terms of our biases. So we can literally sit here on this call and say, oh, I would never be biased. And yet it still happens. We still will not gravitate to that call with that person. We won't pronounce their name right. We will, you know, we'll give them nicknames instead of calling them by their name. I mean, we literally are always like, sadly, making things more comfortable for us. So if you want to be a watchdog for this, you know, you're paying attention to that in yourself and others in any kind of environment. You're making sure like questions are asked fairly, that people are given a fair shot. Literally though, like there are technologies that screen out names on resumes so that you won't be biased. They screen out, you know this, I learned this at the women's prison. There are background check companies like Checker, C-H-E-C-K-R, that use AI to screen out criminal background history from resumes so they will get a fair shot. It's called fair chance hiring. Literally because they know these candidates would make it through if it were not for that initial screen that literally knocks so many people out of the box, they never even get a conversation. So I think if you want to be part of an equitable organization, like we got to look at recruitment first and foremost. And then it goes on to retention, which is what happens once. If you get them in, can you keep them? If you get people into an organization and then the culture sucks and their bias is rampant and there's no commitment to diversity and inclusion and nobody's talking about it and there's no diversity at the top because it's not a priority, you know, the cracks start to be created for that new employee. And that new employee is noticing and sort of, you know, getting some serious headwinds, no advocates for them, no sponsor, nobody's like looking out for them. There may not be any affinity groups. So in some companies I work with, the bigger ones, there's the Women's Network, there's the Black Network, there's LGBTQ. In some of my clients, there's like tens of thousands of people in these groups. I mean, they're like cities unto themselves. And they're very powerful, and it's beautiful to see because there's strength in numbers, there's safety in numbers, and these in bigger companies are sort of officially sanctioned by the company. They're funded, they have an executive sponsor that's assigned to them, there's tens of thousands of employees. They're viewed not as this like, oh, we're going to get together and complain, or oh, we're going to get together and have, you know, cocktail parties. In the companies I work with that I'm sort of nudging along to be like, these are business resources. Like these groups of people are your future workforce. They're actually today's workforce, PS. But like there's so much denial at the top of the house that it's sort of like, you know, you have to kind of convince people to say like, look, you are way behind the times. Like look at your masthead, look at your board, look at your C-suite, look at the three levels down from the C-suite. Look how few women and people of color there are. And we're talking usually single digits and in the teens for representation for women and people of color in like the top three levels of most organizations I work with. So it is dire. It is not at all like the world we live in. It's not at all like our current and future customers. And so, you know, when I'm dealing with that group and talking to them, I say like, hey, you're very much at risk of, you know, making a mistake in the public domain, being called out in social media for your workplace practices and your lack of diversity. Like, what are you doing about it? Because, and not only that, you aren't harnessing the innovation that's there when you get diverse voices in a room working together. That's where the goodness happens. That's where you are able to see around a corner from a competitive perspective and, you know, anticipate a change in the market. Or get to a diverse market of buyers in a respectful way so that they will buy more products and services from you. You know, all of that is accomplished or not by having that right diversity mix at the table when decisions are made. And so we call that the business case for diversity. That's what we have to argue at the top, because to your point about empathy, empathy is not going to win the day. I wish I could make the moral argument that this is the right thing to do and why don't you just do it? But I have to come armed with 15 other reasons why.
And metrics
and data and studies. And then I need more studies. You know, it's not even just enough to have several studies. Like, you know, they will literally argue with you about the data. And it's discouraging that I have to be in those rooms and like convince people about the why this is important. I mean, honestly, it hurts my heart.
And if you're passionate about it, anybody who's passionate about it, if you're willing to realize that you have to figure out the way in the door, right? And so if that means I have to come with data and metrics and business cases, if that's what's going to get their attention,
I'll do it. Then I'll take it.
That's the route you take. You can't get upset over the fact that it's about knowing how to deal with people that frankly have bias.
And I mean, we say in consulting, meet the client where they're at, you know, and that's critical. I mean, there's no point in leaving people behind or, you know, sprinting ahead with the assumption that progress is going to happen. And we've got to go back and get people, because the people we're going back to get are in many cases the ones that have a lot of power to make change. And we cannot leave that group behind for many reasons. I mean, I don't think, you know, are we being truly inclusive of all if we're just having a conversation about how great progress is amongst people that already get it, you know? And I think that, so my second book was very much written to kind of run back. I always think of it as a burning house. It's a house on fire. And I'm like running back into the house and people are asleep. And I'm like, hey, I'm here to like get you out of the burning house. Like, let's get you out. Let's get you informed. Let's get you in the conversation, because you're going to suffer. I mean, eventually the world is changing and there's going to be pain. We can deny the pain is actually happening, but it's already happening. It's just that sometimes business metrics don't look at that pain. They don't see it. They don't think they're losing people. They think they're great. We love to think we're great. We love to think I'm a great leader. Like, that is so enticing to say, oh, I have daughters. Like, of course women feel comfortable working here. Well, we don't have a pay gap. What are you talking about? I would never pay anybody unfairly, you know? And then I'm the consulting team that comes in and is like, guess what? Hate to tell you.
Numbers don't lie.
Yeah. And it's a shock. They're ashamed. They're horrified, you know, all that. And so you have to kind of get back to convincing, showing the data, and then bringing people forward to say, okay, now I know I have a problem. Now I know I'm not a sort of infallible, perfect, well-intended person. Now what can I do? And that's where it gets really interesting. Like, I love the how conversation once you've kind of moved people through the why and you sort of solved for that.
Do you know what I found interesting during my prison visit?
Mm.
While, you know, Rachel and I both come from a performance background, so we have been exposed to that. And if there were more moms and dads that had that background and were exposed to certain, like, believe it or not, Rachel, I started out dancing. Well, actually, I started out singing. Mm. Then I moved to dancing in high school. And just having to undress and get naked in front of everybody, right? Like,
so true.
You just start to become this accepting family of everybody, whoever you are. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty sure the guy I was dating it for a minute was gay, and I didn't know it because that was, you know, back in the late 80s.
Back in the day, yes.
But my,
we've all been there.
My experience at the prison was an eye-opening situation for me, thinking that I have no bias. And the second I got to the prison, I had bias and didn't realize it. Like, I was terrified, right? So day one, so I'm like, what am I getting myself into right now? And then day one, and I volunteered for that. I heard all of you women speak. And then we did that tour of the call center. And then we kind of were like let loose. But no, those women didn't know me yet because I wasn't on the panel. And Michelle is like, hey, we're not going to do round tables. Why don't you just go find a group of women to talk to? I'm like, okay.
Okay.
And that's when the fear set in that I'm like, oh my gosh, I don't think I realized my unconscious bias until I sat down with those women that first day. Mm-hmm. And they're like, who are you? And I said, oh, I'm your trainer tomorrow. I'm coming in to do sales training with you tomorrow. Oh, you're the woman doing the improv. And I was so uncomfortable, but I had to like get over that and say, so let's talk about how is it on the phones? What do you hate about being on the phones? And once I could open the door and crack the nut, it was like I wasn't in a prison.
Mm.
And then when I went back the next day and did these two sessions, and they had all volunteered to be there.
Right.
And their enthusiasm and their hearts and how they were sponges, right? You've done a lot of training and people are like, oh God, the trainer's here.
Right, right.
And I was like, I will come work in a prison every day.
It feels so good to be wanted and needed. And
yeah.
And you don't want to leave because we feel so valued. Like, and then it begs the question, like you said, how often don't I feel valued? How often do I feel like I'm pushing the boulder uphill to even be heard about something I know is important, right? It's such a dichotomy.
It's such a win-win in that moment because these women were not women in prison. These women were women looking to learn.
And we have that in common, which is bigger than everything.
Yeah.
And that could have been us in the prison. I mean, that was the thing that kept going through my mind is, you know, but there, but for, you know, one or two mistakes. And like, how profound is that to think about the accident of life and birth and privilege and, you know, falling in with the wrong crowd. And I don't know if everybody watched Chelsea Handler's documentary on white privilege. She goes back to see her boyfriend who's African American all these years later. And they literally would get in trouble together for years. And he went to prison for 13 years and she got off. Like, she was in the car with him. She was doing all the things that he was doing. But their lives kind of took this dramatic turn separately because of all these sort of systemic biases we have in our system. And it's such a deep moment to realize every single day that we didn't make a mistake that landed us in that. It means that we have to give back. Like, that's the call to action, I feel like, because if I got lucky, it wasn't because I deserved to get lucky.
Well, it's funny because I said, because I was so uncomfortable and I was trying to find common ground, right? Mm. So I told them the story of my dad working for the mob and how as children, he made us work in a flea market selling items that I believe were stolen. And that was kind of the way I broke the ice with them. And I said, you know, any one of us is 5 minutes from a felony. And like, I couldn't believe that came out of my mouth. but they appreciated it.
Yeah, I bet.
Because the next day their supervisor was like, they loved you. And I'm like, why?
I bet they did.
Why? Because you were so down to earth and real with
them.
You're
so real. So real. Yeah, I know. And I'm such a silver spoon kid. Like, I don't even have that kind of story in my background. It's just crazy, the privilege I had growing up. But I loved, in my round table talk, they asked me tons of questions about just, I don't know, like dealing with bias and as women and what they would face in the world that they would be going out into, right, as professionals, which is what's so cool about this apprentice program they have with Televerde. And just like, what do I tell them about, you know, that how women, even who haven't been in prison, struggle to be heard and seen and valued. And then what they're going to contend with in addition to that.
Yeah.
Like, and then when do they reveal their true story? It's in many ways, like being LGBTQ, you know, it's that how, when do I reveal my story? Will I ever talk about it? And when I do talk about it, how will I be judged as a colleague? Will I continue to get a fair shot if people know that I was in prison? It's similar. It is similar. It's nowhere near the degree, but it's the feeling of it, the hiding of something so that people won't judge you is very similar to being LGBTQ. And remembering, like, half of LGBTQ people are in the closet in the workplace today. So half of us, 50% of us are lying on a day-to-day basis about who we love, who our families are, what we did over the weekend, you know, lying, like no pictures on the desk, no mention. So I think perhaps maybe that was the thing I could have in common, not literally, but metaphorically speaking, around covering and hiding and
that situation, your situation, isn't a matter of public record.
Nope.
Like someone who's committed a crime.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So I can pass. And that's, again, that's a privilege, right? That is absolutely. And you would never think about like being closeted as a privilege, but actually like comparatively. And I don't like to do we say like, let's not play the pain Olympics. Like there is like this, this hierarchy of oppression and it's not really helpful to kind of do, but at the same time, it is helpful to acknowledge that there are actually literally ways I can game the system and like be invisible and get by. And there's other ways that others can't. And it is your matter of public record, and you're right. And that's why the recruitment process is so important, the background check process is so important. I learned so much from this woman at Checker. I just learned so much about Ban the Box and Fair Chance Hiring and the size of this potential workforce that does not have a shot in a time when we have such a labor shortage, and in a time when every single company says to me, I can't find enough women and I can't find enough people of color to hire. You're telling me I need more diverse hires and I can't find them. So there is literally this like gap that we can close through awareness of bias, through kind of having like background check companies and search firms and recruitment agencies who are providing candidates and saying, no, these people are actually imminently qualified. And what gets in their way is this sort of complete like rejection of that particular part of their background. Like, let's change that. And then let's open up this, you know, it is a giant, like multiple millions of people who are sitting on the sidelines that could be, you know, sitting in these jobs that we have open. And so that was a huge eye opener for me. And so I have tried to now incorporate that in every diversity presentation I give. And I sometimes see a lot of people recoil in the audience. The second you say criminal backgrounds, like you'll see people be like, well, we can't do that here. That would never fly at my company. And so that, to me, that's what I love to do, is sort of plant a seed.
Yeah.
And then like, I know that we're not really ready for that conversation, but some companies are ready for that conversation, but that's few and far between. And I, as a messenger, need to make sure I'm bringing that into the room. Even though I was not incarcerated, I need to represent those women. Now that I met them,
yeah,
I have to talk about that. Like, and I hope that business wakes up and says, like, this isn't fair. And by the way, we're hurting ourselves. We're literally not accessing this giant pipeline that, by the way, is more loyal, more passionate. Once they get in the door, hardworking. There's all sorts of really interesting statistics about, as a group, how the formerly incarcerated behave once in the workplace when given a shot. The metrics are off the charts in terms of those things that we all say we look for in an employee. So how do we fix that?
One step at a time.
So much to do.
It's the Michelles of Televerde of the world that, you know, she gets out there and like the Pied Piper, a lot of us start to follow. And so it's.
She's going to be on my podcast, by the way, on The Will to Change.
Oh, good. She's awesome. Yeah,
she is awesome. Her personal story at being formerly incarcerated and now the voice that she has. I'm following her lead and I'm sort of gobbling up everything that she gives, and I want to put her in front of my audiences because my audience is a lot of organizational leaders, you know, who are making these kinds of decisions.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If you want, I don't know if you heard the episode she did with us. I'll send you the link to it.
We'll get that out
so that you can just hear how she was on our show.
Lovely. I would love to do that.
Well, we could keep talking to
you. Where did the time go?
We could talk to you forever, like Rachel's sitting on every word. I'm sitting on every word.
Oh, it's a good conversation. Whose time has come, I think.
I know. We do have, and this was such an easy conversation with you.
Is it not always
easy? No, it is, but I'm like, we do prepare questions, which your team, by the way, is amazing. You have an amazing team, which I'd like
to
talk
about.
I'm so proud
and honored. You cannot have them. I'm just kidding.
No, I want your advice on growing them because I know I have a lot of work to do and you've been where I am. I prepare questions. So we had questions.
And we don't even need them.
We never needed to use
them. I love it. That happens to me too. You know why? Because my friend described it as like the universe takes over and it shapes the conversation and you just follow that.
Yeah, exactly.
And you follow your curiosity and you have such an intuitive sense of, I think, you're obviously your audience and the issue and your own personal experience. And so literally it's I have that same thing that happens. I think as women, let me just make the point, we like over prepare for life. Feel like we never think we're ready to just literally go with our gut and our intuition and that we're enough, like that we know enough. We are enough and we know enough. And I think it's gendered. I really, really do. And I think unfortunately, this shows up in the way we show up in our workplaces. Remember that men will apply for a job that they have like 30% of the qualifications for. Women will apply for it only if they have 120% of the qualifications. We are constantly stressing ourselves about being prepared and being perfect. And I think we really need to revisit that. Elizabeth Gilbert, I love her, just spoke at Texas Conference for Women where I was presenting. Her big theme right now is, I don't care. I don't care. I don't care about getting back to you. I don't care about being all the things. I don't care about reading all my emails. I don't care about like always being responsible and being organized and making sure I get back to everyone. she's on this kick where she's like, I just deleted thousands of emails from my inbox and like that I didn't read. And I'm not sorry. And it's just the women in the audience just like roared. We were like, thank you for the permission to even think for a moment, like, I don't have to be all these things. Like, it's exhausting me. It's bad for me. I'm not showing up well in the world. Pick a couple things and know that you're enough, because I don't know. It struck me, and I try to model that too. I'm like, you know what? Don't make perfect the enemy, the good. Don't give into that.
Ooh,
right?
That's good.
We are great as we are. And we've learned enough. We have learned more than enough. So you don't need the notes.
That Rachel, that sounds like what she just said. It sounds like the answer to one of our signature questions. We don't even need to ask that.
Oh, gosh. Sorry.
Which one?
ask me.
Yeah. All of them, all at the same time about what kind of advice you might give anybody. What kind of advice would you give for anybody who's struggling with bias?
Yeah, let me give another answer. Like, bring your full self, like commit to your authenticity, because I know it's hard, and I know it may be easy for me to say this because the way I walk through the world, I don't trigger certain kinds of biases. So I totally granted that, but you in honoring all of who you are and bringing that with you, you are literally influencing any kind of system, any kind of group you're in, team of two, company of 100,000. So the truth you bring, the authenticity, the honoring of you is literally just by itself sort of going to shift hearts and minds. And it can feel scary, and you can feel the pressure to cover and minimize who you are. But if we wait for the powers that be to make the change, we're going to be waiting a long time. And I'm working on that. That's my job. I'm working on that. And I'm trying to wake them up and, you know, get them into the game. But in the meantime, we can create change from wherever we are. And I would also say, be a great ally. Like, really think about whose voice is not being heard. How can I be a voice for or alongside somebody? How can I take an action item so that we can correct something? How can I be vigilant for all those things that we talked about earlier? And know that in you doing that, it's probably easier for you to do it than somebody else who's kind of dealing directly with those biases. So stand up for those things and use your voice.
Awesome. Rachel, you want to ask her that one question?
Yeah, let's go with one.
Another funny question.
Okay.
Since this is the podcast that makes everything sexy again, how do you define the word sexy?
Ooh, I think it's about power. I would hope most women would answer that way. I would bet men would not answer that way. I think for us, power is sexy because we don't have it often. So to have it, to exhibit it, to embody it, I feel the most powerful and yes, sexy, although I hate to think about that word when I'm in a room full of clients, because it's not about that, but internally I know that when I'm speaking with authority and I'm coming from this deeply embodied, authentic place, that is the most powerful. And therefore, you know, I think the most sexy I ever am, is that authenticity. So you gotten that answer before?
No. No, really? And every answer is different. That's the kind of like when we ask if you're a woman your mother warned you about, and whenever we ask about sexy, we get different answers. And I think it's important to share different answers because you have, like you say, you have to show up being who you are. So there's not one answer.
Yeah, I love that. I love that.
So it's been so great having you with us. So thank you so much for being on the show. And if people want to connect with you, what is the best way to do that?
So thank you for asking. I have two books, one called Inclusion from 2017 was my first. And then my second just came out in August. It's called How to Be an Inclusive Leader. They're different, but I think both worth a read. Perhaps the first book is about the why and the second book is really about the how. Now you're ready to roll up your sleeves and do your individual work. I have a podcast, as I talked about, called The Will to Change. I am on Twitter and Instagram a lot. Twitter is at Jennifer Brown, Instagram at Jennifer Brown Speaks. And then you can find information about me on LinkedIn and Facebook under Jennifer Brown Consulting. And I think that's all the things. If you're listening to this and you're in an organization and you would like to work with an amazing and talented consulting team, which I am honored to do this work with every day at Jennifer Brown Consulting, please drop us an email at info@jenniferbrownconsulting.com.
Awesome. Awesome. So we'll put all of that in the show notes for people to connect with you. So thanks again, Jennifer, for being on the show. And thank you, Warners, for listening to this episode of Women Your Mother Warned You About, and to our sponsor, Dermavogue, who keeps Rachel and I looking prettier than we already are. To connect with me directly and learn more about Pivot 10 Results and Carolina Improv, you can find my information on our website, womenyourmotherwarnedyouabout.com. And Rachel?
And to connect with me, Rachel Pitts, you can find me all over social media as Rachel on Real Estate. And to find all our social media links and free downloads, go to our website, womenyourmotherwarnedyouabout.com.
And remember, Warners, for the best relationships, keep it real, raw, and relevant.
And a little irreverence doesn't hurt either.
Bye, Warners.
This really will get serious soon.
Yeah, it doesn't have to. I don't think anybody wants it to be serious.
This has been a presentation of the Sell or Die Network. For more podcasts that you can take out into the street and turn into money, visit sellordienetwork.com.